Welcome to another edition of the Spirit Revolution. My name is Philip Cobbins.
My name is Kathleen McGowan.
And today we'll be talking about Sacred France. What is it that the French have which no other culture or no other country in the world really seems to have? It's a magnet which has pulled both Kathleen and me and so many others who have come with us or who have gone to France by themselves to La Douce France. So, Kathleen, what is so sweet about France for you?
Oh, well, it's a good thing the show's an hour long because it's going to take that long. It would take many hours, I think, for me to talk about all the things that I love about France. But I think that what we need to start with is what is currently drawing people there. And because I think this idea of Sacred France is growing. I think that, you know, you and I spend a lot of time there. We go back several times a year. We go to these very sort of specifically spiritually charged places. And we have observed that there are more and more people coming there now. And more people coming not as tourists, but as pilgrims. And that's really what I want to talk about. What is it about France that is now inspiring these intense transformational pilgrimages versus just the traditional tourist experience? I mean, certainly you can go and enjoy the Eiffel Tower and fabulous shopping and the coast and the beaches and Cannes and all of those glamorous places. Provence is beautiful. You know, all of those things are lovely and fantastic experiences for vacation. But there is this other side of France. There is this element of France that is so deep and so mystical and so extraordinary that now more than ever in the 21st century, people are being drawn there. And I want to throw it back at you because my question for you is this. I have a very different perspective as an American, I think, than you do. So we'll come back to my American point of view and the experiences that my American friends and readers have had when I have taken them over to France. But I'd like to throw it back at you as a European, as someone born in Belgium, as someone who has spent a lot of time across the broad expanse of Europe. Why do you think that France is so specifically mystical, more so than any other part of Europe?
Well, it's a very good question, and I think it's one which is both easy to answer and one which is very difficult to answer. I think the simple answer, and to some extent the real answer, is that France has somehow preserved a way of living which very few other countries in Europe really have. The closest is probably Greece, but Greece is a radically different culture. But the heartbeat of the past, and an ancient past, an extremely old heartbeat, you can find in France. Now, in Greece, you know, obviously you get transported to the time of democracy, the birth of guys like Plato and all of the other great Greek people. But in France, it's not so much the people. It's not Napoleon, or it's not Voltaire, it's not Rabelais. It's not even, you know, Caesar invading it or the Celts. It is this fact that this land has a heartbeat. And I was just the other week in Belgium and the Netherlands, and I was driving around a bit and also doing a bit by train. And Belgium is on the cusp of France. It's almost France, but not yet quite. And you can see how it changes. When you go from Amsterdam, you see a very modern, industrialized, quite, very beautiful country. But then it slowly begins to transform. Now, in Belgium, you know, Belgium has got the country, but not the respect that people have given to the country. In Belgium, basically the Belgians have abused their own country, and they're beginning to realize that. But then when you go further south, you begin to realize that the French have got respect for their country, and it expresses themselves in many ways. They will keep restoring extremely old buildings. They will not break them down. Whenever they build something, it'll be, apart from in certain parts of Paris or other big cities, are quite in vogue with the countryside. The countryside in France is at peace, and everybody who is living in there has always been kind of like at peace with this rhythm. It's almost as if the land puts you back and kind of like gives you a sense of what it is to live within the earth or with the earth. And I think, you know, France is one of those places where you can still do that. And I think when, you know, Europeans, specifically the Dutch or the English, and when they go abroad, there are various classes of people. You have the people who go for the sunshine and they end up right on the coast. And they end up living in apartments and sometimes in completely new development blocks if they choose for Spain. But there are an awful lot of Europeans from Belgium, the Netherlands, and England who go to rural France. And they really begin to live in a way that is sometimes impossible to be like in their own country, but also to create what I would call their great work, and which is to dedicate their life to building or restoring quite often a home according to what they want, and then also to have the lifestyle which they want. Because let there be no doubt about it, France isn't a 24/7 economy. And the classic joke which you and I have is the 8-to-8, the 8-to-8, which is, you know, France's version of shops which should be open until from 8 o'clock in the morning to 8 o'clock at night. But Kathleen, what is your experience of shops like that?
I love the 8-to-8. In the southwest of France, there is a market called 8-to-8, and it's a kind of a grocery store come 7-Eleven type of thing for us. And of course, it's supposed to be open from 8 o'clock to 8 o'clock, and actually, in reality, it opens at about 9:30, whatever time they get there, is open till noon, closes for lunch from noon to 2-ish, and opens when they're done with lunch and closes between 6 and 6:30, unless something cool is happening, in which case it closes at 4, but it is never, in fact, open from 8 to 8. And I love that example because it is it's France. It's exactly how things are down there. It is, they live there in a way. As an American, it's astonishing. That can be very frustrating for Americans, because Americans, nothing's ever open and things close at lunch. And, you know, we have this very sort of rigid idea of what the work ethic should be like and all of those things. And I love going to that part of France because it forces me to slow down. It forces me to get into that rhythm of remembering why we're all here, and we're here to live, and we're here to enjoy ourselves and our lives and our family. And the work is secondary. Yeah, you know, it'll happen, but it's not primary. And that is one of the things that I love about rural France particularly, is the pace. And I think the pace alone, even if the land were not sacred, which it is, and we'll come back to that, just the pace alone in France is very, very healthy for those of us who come from these sort of type A overachieving cultures. So just going into a place that forces you to slow down while being surrounded by this extraordinary beauty and ridiculous food and amazing wine, you know, that in itself is a pretty spiritual experience. But you factor in the idea that the land itself is supporting you in having a spiritual transformation. That's when all of a sudden you have this miraculous place, which is specifically the Languedoc. But there are also other elements and places in France that I think are equally sacred.
Absolutely. And when you look at some of the novels and, you know, your own, The Da Vinci Code, some of Steve Barry's books, so many books are set in France. I don't know whether it's a trend in America, but definitely there is a trend of, like, the popular autobiography of the person who leaves everything behind and settles himself into the Provence and kind of, like, adapts this lifestyle and starts dedicating his life to cooking and living with the land and you know, eating from the land and living in tune with the seasons. All of those things are extremely popular in Europe. From a political point of view, France is considered to be the odd one out in Europe because France is unwilling to let go of this, there shouldn't be a 24/7 economy. Even a city like Paris on a Sunday is quite often closed.
Don't try to go shopping in Paris on Sunday. You will not be successful.
Absolutely. And, you know, but France has this attraction, and I think it is because, and it's, you know, I, there is definitely something amongst the French who says, you know, we want to change. But then the question is kind of like, you know, is the landlord allowing them to change? Because whatever Sarkozy or whatever some of the French try to do, the French lifestyle remains very much, again, in league with the seasons, in league with this ancient heartbeat of the place. And we have been focusing on a few places, and we're obviously going to use them. Chartres is definitely one of them. Brittany is another. And the place, of course, which is closest to our heart and so many millions of other people who go there on pilgrimages, is the Languedoc-Roussillon.
So let me ask you this, because you know a lot about the idea of sacred land from a geographical perspective. You've run around the world looking at geographical anomalies. You've looked at pyramids. There's a lot of talk in France, you know, in terms of sacred geometry. There's a lot of talk about the rose line, ley lines, that type of thing. What do you think? Do you think that there is an artery that runs through France that is specifically powerful in the earth that causes a certain type of energy that is different from the rest of the world?
The short answer is yes. Do I think it's ley lines? I'm not too sure. But I go back to, you know, my first fascination with France began at the age of about 19 to 20. And I came across a book called Atlantis by a Belgian history professor called Marcel Mestac. And unfortunately, Marcel had died a few weeks before the publication of the book from a sudden heart attack. But Marcel was a very dedicated researcher. And Marcel was a history teacher, and part of his main vocation was the Vikings. And he studied the way Vikings moved about into Europe. And everybody just believes that Vikings in Europe came, conquered, and sacked. And he felt that that wasn't the case. He said, look, the way they move around the English countryside seems that if they're focusing on one specific spot, which they seem to find in that specific place. And then they abandon England and start doing the same kind of weaving system and eventually end up in a town called Sarre, which is outside of Paris and is known for one of its major cathedrals as well. And he says, what is there about Sarre? What is there about this thing in the landscape that somehow made them be able to zoom into this place? And he noted, first of all, that Sarre was one of the few places, in fact, the only place in France, that the Vikings didn't sack. They put it under siege and waited for the city to surrender. Mm-hmm. So he felt that the Vikings were onto something. And so what he did was, even though he had a disabled wife who needed pretty much care in the morning and care at night, he jumped on his car and looked at maps and began to study what it was. And he found an extremely intricate system of roads and dikes on the landscape, some of them kind of like zooming in on Sarre, some of them in circles around Sarre, and some of them in like ovals around Sarre. And when he started to measure them, he realized that what he had found were the dimensions as written down by Plato of Atlantis. And he felt that this was one of the main reasons as to what was going on in France. Now, he didn't specifically say, okay, Atlantis is in France. What he was saying is the dimensions as written down by Plato coexist in France with the megalithic civilization. And he realized that all the megaliths in France were really located according to a certain pattern, a gigantic network taking up pretty much three-thirds of what is the France of today. So he also then realized that places like Rouen, Calais, Dieppe, all of the famous places, Chartres, Sarre, all of these Paris, all of these places were not randomly assigned just anywhere a place on the landscape, but were remains of extremely old power spots which people had come to across centuries, millennia, for thousands and thousands of years. So, whereas if you were to look at America, where you see just a very modern urbanized style of growth whereby the Native American power spots are largely completely unintegrated into the landscape, what you have in France is an evolution of something which is thousands of years old. And I think that's very much why France is different from any other place in the world, or at least places like America and the rest of Europe?
Well, one of the things that we see repeatedly in France, where there are cathedrals, where there is a sacred site or even a Christianized site, is something that we do see elsewhere in Europe, but it manifests somewhat differently in France, and that is this. There are layers upon layers upon layers of spiritual and mystical history in these places. So, for example, the places of which you speak, Sens, and for our American friends, that's S-E-N-S, also Chartres. So what we have in Chartres, for example, is a place that for as long as there is recorded history, we know has been a place of worship for many, many different types of peoples and practices. The region around Chartres itself is actually named for the divine feminine. It is named for the mother goddess. The female aspect of God. So we know that there has been this deep, powerful, maternal lineage of spirituality in that region for at least 5,000 years, probably much, much longer. And where the cathedral is now has been a site of worship, again, since the dawn of human history. There have been temples there. There have been some kind of structure there. And certainly the holy well that is now in the crypt in Chartres Cathedral is considered one of the most sacred places on earth. It's been called the pulse point of the mother. It's been called the womb of earth. I mean, this is a place of such extraordinary power. And people in the ancient times came from all over Europe, the whole expanse of Europe, to come to this particular spot for initiation purposes. So here we have something that has been sacred ground, so incredibly important that people have come from across the seas and across the continents to participate in ceremonies. And it is now the site of the most important and most beautiful cathedral in the world. So there is certainly an enormous amount of history, layer upon layer upon layer, in a lot of these places. And I think that that is part of it as well, because there is a patina on places like Chartres wherein you feel those layers and layers and layers of history. When you walk into Chartres Cathedral, you are not just feeling the grandeur of Gothic architecture. You are not just experiencing the beauty of stained glass and the history of France. You are instead transformed by this incredible energy of thousands of years of people of spirit and power being in this place. I believe that Chartres is truly one of the most powerful and sacred places on planet Earth.
Absolutely. And as you say, Chartres is built on top of you know, layers upon thousands and thousands of years. People still say that at the very foundation of Chartres, literally foundation in the literal sense, there might still be an ancient dolmen, which would take us back, several thousands of years old. And people have been building on top and on top. And the cathedral is just the most recent example, even though it dates back almost a millennium, to this history. I think that is different from elsewhere in Europe as well. Again, going back to my native Belgium, there's nothing which a Belgian likes as much as doing as destroying a building and starting from fresh. It's somewhat different in England. England and Scotland have a slightly more hold to the past of kind of like restoring old buildings. But France, once again, is the place where this is most apparent. And I think the fact that, you have that respect for the past and the past is there also means that the heartbeat of the past is there. Nothing ever got destroyed except certain things at the time of the French Revolution, which probably needed to be cleansed anyway.
Oh, okay. I'm going to disagree with you on that. French Revolution was responsible for the destruction of so much important, beautiful, spiritual history in France. It is the second greatest tragedy. Of course, the first greatest tragedy is the incredible loss of life. But the destruction of so many of the cathedrals and the religious treasures, so many things were burned, so many things were destroyed. I can only begin to imagine what we would be able to access and know about French history if the revolution had not happened. As someone who has been researching France for 20 years, my frustrations over and over again are, oh, well, this doesn't exist anymore because it was burned down during the revolution. These records are gone. These libraries are gone. So the destruction that occurred during the French Revolution was horrible for those of us who care about the spiritual history of France.
Oh, yes, definitely. But what I'm what I was trying to hint at is like this fact that after the French Revolution, you once again see this building work, this gigantic, you know, building work, which specifically in Paris, where the French once again embrace this thing, and Mitterrand is probably the most recent example of this. The French have never stopped building, and there was a period around the 18th century where they kind of like had lost that sense of kind of like, you know, empowering the earth with their building works, and after the revolution they had that spirit once again, and they continue to have this. I mean, as an example of something which very few people know, but if they go on my website or people visiting France and having some spare time to spare around Charles de Gaulle Airport, just outside of Charles de Gaulle, they have made a new town, completely new. And along the line of this town, it's called the Central Axis. And the Central Axis is a beautiful axis which runs through the town. And it involves obelisks. It involves buildings which are placed in a certain way. You then go down to steps where specific plants have been done. There are specific fountains. You go even further down, and they even have the top of a pyramid which sticks out of a lake, and it's a wonderful piece of art. It's one of François Mitterrand's lovely ideas, even though French historians say he had nothing to do with it. Well, you know, he kind of like he had and he hadn't. But there is this sense in France today still that they have to do these gigantic building works. And it ties back in my kind of like, you know, to what I was saying with Marcel Mistak material, that everything they do, all their building, whether we look at Chartres, whether we look at megaliths, whether we look at this line just outside of Charles de Gaulle, whether we look at the Louvre, there is sense, there is meaning embedded into everything they do. And to stay for a little while more on Chartres, it's every square centimeter or inch of Chartres has meaning.
Absolutely.
And that it is just, you know, unique. I have never seen anywhere else in any other country, and you and I have seen cathedrals in an awful lot of places, but the intensity, the density of meaning per square inch is nowhere as great as in France, and nowhere in France as great as in Chartres.
Well, every inch of Chartres, inside and out, is completely considered, and that's really the most extraordinary element of it. But I think that we would be remiss, while we're still here in this part of France, before we head south where we're about to go, our favorite place, but I think we would be remiss if we did not discuss one other place in this region that is also incredibly carefully considered and tremendously misunderstood, and that place is Versailles.
Oh, yes. Because Versailles, let's face it, it's just a holiday retreat, isn't it, for the French king?
Versailles is so extraordinary for so many reasons that have nothing to do with opulence and mirrors. There is so much going on in Versailles. There is so much esoteric symbolism embedded in the construction. The gardens throughout Versailles over multiple generations, whether it was Louis XIV's Hypnerotomachia Gardens or Marie Antoinette's Tree of Life Gardens, there is so much esoteric symbolism going on within these gardens, not just for the sake of decoration or beauty, but because these monarchs, these extraordinary families of nobility, also had the information about the sacred nature of their land, and they knew how to use it. And they were attempting, I believe, and you believe, and we're going to be writing about this some more, to capture that energy, to utilize that energy, to work with the sacred nature of the land within the landscape of Versailles. And if you can go to Versailles looking at it, again, not from the point of view as a tourist, but from the point of view of a pilgrim, what what unfolds before you is a very, very different Versailles from the portrait of Mary Magdalene hanging at the side of Louis XIV's bed to the extraordinary St. Michael elements that are embedded in fireplaces, and of course the gardens. You will see that Versailles is a temple of esoterica and mysticism.
Absolutely. And I mean, one of the things you and I started to discuss just after we kind of like, you know, barely met each other was the fact that I always wanted to experience the gardens of Versailles according to Louis XIV's little guidebook, which tackles, you know, a section of the Garden of Versailles, which actually isn't that, I think, all that popular. And I was very happy to see that in May of this year, unlike on previous visits to Versailles, they now actually are stocking up big time the guide of Louis XIV to how the Garden of Versailles should be seen and experienced through his eyes. And the way that was, as you said, according to the Hypnotherapia Polyphili, or the Dream of Polyphili, which is an early 16th century book of quite, you know, specific origins. It's a very incredible book. It's a very hard book to digest, and we will probably come back to it on a complete show of it. But it shows you how a garden, which people quite often just see for the beautiful landscaping and the beautiful horticulture, actually has a complete esoteric part in full view. You know, the petite train which goes through it also goes through kind of like that part of the garden, and it's not pointed out, it's not that visible, but there's a very esoteric part of the garden just there. And you know, it's Versailles, and it's, you know, it's could be anywhere else, but it is in Versailles. And as you're also pointing out, and we discussed in the time slip episode, other parts of the garden definitely show that whatever the French did, whatever they designed, always had that very specific meaning, that very special purpose. And not just on the traditional lines of beauty and architecture or even cosmic proportions, but a very profound and esoteric knowledge, meaning that every place in France you can read on so many levels.
For those of you who are listening and have heard the show before, you can also check out, if you go to our archives at thespiritrevolution.com, we did a show a few weeks back on time slips. And on the Versailles time slip, we talk about it very specifically. We talk about how there is a time anomaly that happens in certain parts of France, and specifically in Versailles. So if you want to take a look at that or have a listen to that, definitely check out the archives, because we don't have time to go into that now, because we need to move south to the place that certainly owns my heart more than any other in the world, and that is the magical, mystical, and entirely sacred Southwest.
Or, as one booklet around 1980 called it, Rennes-le-Château, the secret capital of France. Because, really, the Languedoc has become the secret and definitely a sacred region of France, hasn't it?
Absolutely. And you and I both ended up there within days, maybe weeks of each other in 1995. Of course, we didn't know each other then. But I've since discovered that a number of the people who I am incredibly close to were all brought to that part of France. We were all there in the late spring of 1995. We were all brought there for the first time. So there was a tremendous energy toward that part of the world that was magnetic. It was pulling all of us there. I certainly first went there doing research for my Magdalene books. I had read Holy Blood, Holy Grail. I had done some investigation into the Cathars. I knew that it was a powerful place mystically, spiritually, but I didn't have really any idea just how powerful. It was one of those things I certainly could not have known that I would never be the same again after I had experienced Cathar country. It changes every... I don't know, it changes you at an atomic level, at a cellular level. And I say that broadly. I say it changes you, because I have never taken anybody there, no matter what their original spiritual or religious background was. No one has ever visited that region that I know who was not changed utterly by the experience of being in this profoundly beautiful, powerful, intense place where the history of thousands of years absolutely breathes out of the stones.
Absolutely. And, you know, that was so powerfully underlined a few weeks ago. I took a dear friend, Chris Winter, who we've interviewed on the show, in relation to, you know, crystal skulls. Chris is 68 years old. He has seen quite a few interesting people, quite a few interesting places, and actually thought he had actually gone to the south of France until just before we left. He actually said, no, I've never been. So we went, and I introduced him to Rennes-le-Château. And as soon as he was introduced to Rennes-le-Château, we didn't plan on doing so. For the next 4 days, we ended up in Rennes-le-Château because Chris couldn't get enough of experiencing Rennes-le-Château. By day four, he was asking locals whether they might have some rooms available for somewhere next year so he could be there for a month. Now, just to paint a bit of what Chris is like. Chris, you know, drives a car. Chris is connected to the internet. Chris watches television. But in France, and specifically in Rennes-le-Château, he knew that there was hardly any internet and he didn't really care. He knew that he could go there and spend there and be happy there for a month, just living there. And as he said, go to that view from the car park and that, you know, that general area, and look out to God's creation, and just be in touch with his true self. And I think that is really at the heart of what that region does. It was actually Chris who was saying, you know, about how the earth around Rennes-le-Château is actually red. And it's red because it contains quite a bit of iron. And iron, of course, has a very specific effect on yourself, on your blood cells, on your, you know, on your electronic, magnetic, or whatever you want to call it, self. So in a very physical and in a very boring way, yes, the red earth of that region really changes you. And that is just, you know, the physical aspect of it. There is so much more about that land that really transforms you, realigns you, revitalizes you, whatever you need or whatever is happening.
Well, there's also the magnetic aspect of everything that's happening in the land, the fact that, you know, watches don't operate properly in certain areas. You know, there are these deeply powerful magnetic impulses in addition to the geological stuff. But I want to talk about the mysticism. I want to talk about the spirit. And I want to talk about why people like Chris and you and me get to Rennes-le-Château and then never want to leave. It's not because there's a demon in the church. It's not because we want to analyze the sacred geometry. It's not because, you know, we want to understand where the treasure is buried that Saunière had. It's none of those things. Those things are crazy, distracting, you know, shallow surface elements that have nothing to do with why we're really there. And why we're really there and why we cannot leave once we arrive is because the place itself is so passionate and deep and beautiful and filled with the history of thousands of years of people who came there to celebrate the power of the human spirit. Rennes-le-Château is one of the great pulse points of the earth. Of course, it's been sacred to Mary Magdalene for as long as anyone can remember. And what was she teaching? She was teaching the way of love there. And when we arrived in 1995, the way of love was not permeating Rennes-le-Château at all. It was a very dark place.
It was a terrible place.
This place was terrible. Yes, it was a terrible place. But thanks to the people who have come into that village and rebuilt it and infused it with the original spirit of which it was meant to thrive. And that is the spirit of love, the spirit of community. Rennes-le-Château is a community. And when you are sitting in that garden with people who are old friends, people who are new friends, you feel that sense of community like nowhere else in the world. I have never felt more at home in my life than when sitting in that garden. You sit there and you say, this is what home feels like, because you are surrounded by community, by beautiful people, like-minded people, by friends. Like I said, new friends. I have never walked in that garden without making a new friend. Have you?
Nope. And again, kind of like, you go there at even if it's dreadful weather, like I was there again a few weeks ago for the end of September, there was one day when my hands were almost freezing off my arms, but everybody just kept sitting there enjoying the company. And people didn't want to go to their homes and watch TV or, read books. People wanted to be there.
It is the living embodiment of the Cather spirit that is happening in Rennes-le-Château right now, and that is what I truly love about it. And when I take people there, and when I go there myself, of course, I try to spend as much time as I can visiting the various Cather sites. There are some that I visit over and over again, like Montségur and Minerve. And then there are so many more to explore. I mean, I really think that we would need to live there for a number of years to see every inch of the place that the Cathars touch, or where there is Cather legacy and history. But again, that legacy of the Cathars, of this people, this culture of extraordinary community who lived for love and for charity, and for faith and nothing else. Their spirit is imbued in that land. And that is part of the nature of what makes it sacred. Because one of the things that I've always found so tremendous about it, one of the reasons that Montségur, and specifically Minerve for me, because Minerve is a big place for me and it doesn't get nearly as much attention as Montségur, but these places hold the energy of how this extraordinary culture lived, and not the energy of how they died. So despite the fact that these are places where there have been terrible massacres, where hundreds of people were burned for their belief, their beautiful belief, of love and faith and community, the land itself does not hold that. In Minerve and Montségur, and even in Lavaur, in that area, it's beautiful. It instead holds the energy of the way these people lived, and it is infused with that. And when you are in these places, you are infused with it as well. And it becomes a catalyst for you. There is a catalytic event that happens when you climb Montségur, for example. Something happens when you climb that mountain, and you feel what those people felt. And by the time you reach the summit of Montségur, something happens in your own body. You want to change. You want to be a better person. You want to be the person you are here to be. There is something so extraordinary about being in the land where people like that lived that it absolutely changes you. And I'm serious when I say every single person I have taken up that hill comes back to America and changes their lives. They quit their jobs. They go off and do what they always dreamed of doing. I mean, something happens there that makes you realize that we are here for a reason, and that reason is about experiencing life and love in a powerful way. And that is the essence of Sacred France for me.
Absolutely, and b before going further on to that aspect of France, the nature of Catharism, I think, is something which is really vibrant there as well. And we were saying how in 1995, Rennes-le-Château was at the pull of various forces, and to some extent, it always has that effect of people who come there in search of treasure, physical treasure. And in the 1920s and the 1930s, the same thing was happening in France to do with the Cathars. Somehow they had the Holy Grail, somehow there was stuff hidden underneath Montségur. We had people like Otto Rahn coming in from abroad and people from England trying to do excavations. And there was an entire movement of digging. And from France itself, a movement came about which said, no, it's not about that. And one of the people who was so principled in it is a guy called Déodat Rochet. And Déodat Rochet, when you read his biography, you will find that he lived to the ripe old age of 100. And apparently, when he was in his 90s, he said, like, I want to experience what it feels like to be 100. And once I have done that, I am okay. And true to form, a few months after reaching the 100-year mark, he passed on. But when you read his biography, you will see that Déodat Rochet was a judge, he was a mayor of Arques, right next to Rennes-le-Château, and he kind of like, he was well received, he was a pillar of community, but he also had a secret side and a secret passion. Every morning when he was in Arques, he would leave his house and walk out of town to walk up to a tiny little oratory where there is a statue of the Virgin Mary. Now, in the 60s and 70s, they were doing some work to the nearby lake, and they actually found that where that oratory was full of ancient remains, that something had been there, and that the statue of the Virgin Mary was basically a Christianizing of an ancient site. Everybody who knew De La Roche knew that this guy lived according to principles which were Cathar to the extreme. And when the 1960s came and the 60 hippie movement came, De La Roche was trying to organize camps in the middle of summer in the area around Arc, whereby people could begin to experience what Cathar living and Cathar life felt like. And he was quite often horrified that some people from the hippie community mistook his camp for something which it wasn't. He really had the idea that the camps had to be all about the Cathars. And, you know, he was principal even before that time in making people focus not so much on the excavations at Montségur, not so much on the burning massacre of Montségur and all the other stuff, but on the religion of Catharism. And he tried to organize seminars and help people to actually get in contact with the nature of Catharism. And I think to some extent that is also what is happening in Rennes-le-Château. I think people are moving away from this idea that it's all about treasure, and they're beginning to look somewhat differently, with different eyes, to whom you know, Baron Gessonnière and Marie de Narno were. At this moment in time, it's kind of like stuck in the stage of where everybody kind of like winks, and kind of like, you know, Sonnière probably had his fling with this woman, seeing they were living together. But I think one of the things is that, you know, Beringer and Marie are going to be inroads into making people realize that the transformation which you, I, and so many other people feel in those places is also a transformation which Sonnière had when he came to live in Rennes-le-Château more than a century ago.
Absolutely. And I hope that you're right when you say that we really are moving away from the treasure hunting idea. I have been very discouraged in the last 2 years by the fact that there are a number of treasure hunting conferences and treasure hunting trips still happening. That particularly infamous treasure hunter / filmmakers are vandalizing areas around Rennes-le-Château and bragging about it. I hope that we are coming to an end of that. I hope that people will not be patronizing those trips that emphasize treasure hunting, because you're not going to find anything. And you're also missing out on the real treasure, because the real treasure of the Languedoc, the real treasure of Rennes-le-Château, is in community, is in the spirit of love and faith and community and celebration of life that actually exists in the village and its surrounding areas itself. And that, I want to come back to the whole idea, which is the title of this show, which is Sacred France. This is sacred ground, and it should not be raped by treasure hunters who are willing to dynamite and destroy and shatter elements of French history because they think they're going to find a Templar tomb or gold. It's time for that to be over. It's time for us to move past that, to evolve into true pilgrims. When we go to this place, I pray you and entreat you, go to it as a pilgrim, as someone who is going to experience with as much honesty and integrity and authenticity, and most of all, respect. Respect for the culture that is there now, respect for the culture that has been there for thousands of years. Treat this place as holy ground, because it is. And I promise you, if you approach this part of France from the point of view of being sacred, it will approach you in the same way. And you will have an experience or experiences more powerful, more profound, and more beautiful than you can possibly imagine.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, to some extent, the attraction of France as a treasure seeker is also to do with your own values. Sacred France, to some extent, acts like a mirror there as well. You come to a place and you don't really understand what it is about, and you mistake physical treasure for, spiritual treasure. If there are treasure seekers out there, or if you're still convinced that there's a physical treasure in Rennes-le-Château, there's a very simple line which I always say: since the 1950s and 60s, every square inch in Rennes-le-Château has been dug up. Trust me. So, you know, if you think that there was something there, it's gone. And, you know, nobody has found something. The treasure is of a different nature. And that, to some extent, is, you know, specifically what, Saulnier kind of like embedded in his church. One of the things which struck Chris and I, which we were talking about, is this inscription. And it's written on the doorway of Rennes-le-Château's church, and it says, "This place is terrible." And it's a quote from, I think, Genesis chapter 28, whereby Jacob is having a dream, and Jacob sees angels ascend and descend from one specific place. And he says, "This place is terrible because this is a gateway between heaven and earth," or words to that effect. And obviously, because it's on the door of the church, you know, when the door opens, the church is obviously a gateway to heaven. But I think Saulnier realized that more than any other place around, Rennes-le-Château has got more energy stored in itself. It has more energy to play with than any other place in its immediate vicinity. And I have, on my website, and we have touched upon it in the time slip episode as well, the way he was building was conformed to very specific rules and regulations of sacred geometry, whereby he really was hoping that his building work would tap into the energies of the land and kind of like transform them and empower them, and that people who would go in there would transform themselves, would become more human. And one of the controversial natures of Saulnier is whether or not he was a Martinist. Well, you know, the evidence suggests he was. And part of the reason why Martinism is so typically French and so ill understood anywhere else is that Martinism at the end of the 19th century was a drive for people like priests like Saulnier or doctors to actually say, people, you are beginning to get quite stuck in your daily routines of just doing the things you do. This kind of like wave where we now, as I think, as an entire civilization are in right now. And Martinism was a call for these people to begin to look at the values of what they were doing and to really embed meaning once again into their lives and to kind of like go beyond the mere reciting but do things with intent and good intentions. And I think that is also something which again has this complex relationship to sacred France. It's the land, but it's also the people. And, bringing back the example of Sarkozy, no matter how much Sarkozy would sometimes wish that France becomes like the 24/7 culture of England or some other countries around him, at the same time, the French know they can't and the French know they don't want it. Because, again, it's sacred France.
Well, one of the things that you and I are fond of saying for various reasons at various times is that the land in France protects itself. Over and over again, we have seen it on so many different levels. The land protects itself. It knows what it wants to be, and it radiates it with so much power. And the people who live there and who are native to it are so in harmony with it that I don't think that they're going to ever let it become anything other than what it should be. And that is a beautiful thing. Also, in terms of Rennes-le-Château is the great amplifier of energy. So what happens there is it will magnify whatever you are dealing with. Whatever your intention is when you arrive there will be amplified. If your intention is to do something good, to learn something, to have a spiritual experience, you will absolutely have one. If your intention is otherwise, if your intention is to take, to destroy, I don't think you're going to have that experience, a good experience there. We have certainly seen people people come there in our own circle who arrived with less than pure intentions. We had someone come with us one year who decided it would be a great idea to try to break into the chateau and see if the grounds of the chateau were holding treasure. And we were all mortified by the fact that anyone would want to do that. And that person's experience in Rennes Le Chateau turned out to be so negative and so horrific because it was such a mirror of the energy that this person brought into Rennes that that person had to leave and actually had to get on a plane and get out of there because it was such a bad experience. And that's because the land will magnify anything that you bring with you, and it will protect itself. It will expel those who come to misuse it. And that's the cautionary tale. And I think that when you're talking about a government perspective, someone like a Sarkozy trying to actually change the cultural structure of France, I think he's got a hell of a fight on his hands.
Absolutely. And, you know, an example of a person who began to really experience the power of Rennes Le Chateau, I think, is the late Jean-Luc Robin. Now, he didn't come with negative intentions at all, but he came with quite a set standard of, like, you know, okay, I'm going to run a business. I've always run businesses before. I know how to run a business, and I'm going to apply this to Rennes Le Chateau. And to some extent it succeeded, and to some extent it failed, because he didn't take in certain parts of the equation. And he didn't disappear, but he kind of like went to nearby Esperanza for a little while, and then came back. And when he came back, he just got it. He realized that he, you know, had a mission in life, which was to help to do his utmost to transform that place and take it away from the let's call it mundane roots which so many people come there, and restore it back to its magical past and also you know, its magical future. And unfortunately, it's a prophecy which came also cruelly true. But when he was back with a vengeance, so to speak, and running for mayor and trying to do all of these things, he said to me, "Philip, you know, I will change this place, even if it's the last thing I will ever do." And unfortunately, Jean-Luc, you know, it was the last thing which you ever did. But it was a person who had come there as an outsider and sort of didn't get it, but who in the end became absolutely committed to what it was like. And I see that a lot in people who come to Rennes Le Chateau, that, you know, even if they don't get it at first, they either run away and never come back, or they're beginning to slowly to get it, and you can see the transformation. And of course, you've got the people who just come there and know from the word why it is so important.
Well, it's been, you know, for me, one of the most gratifying experiences of my life and my career is that I do not spend a single day in Rennes Le Chateau where I don't encounter several people, if not many, who are there because they have read about Rennes Le Chateau in my books, and are there because they want to experience the places that I write about from the point of view of this kind of deep spirituality and not from the point of view of treasure hunting. I have been in at the top of Montsegur and seen people there with my book in their hands, trying to find the place that I write about, wherein the young girl goes down the side of the mountain clutching the Cathar treasure, which of course is the Book of Love, against her. And for me, it is a beautiful thing to encourage people to come there and have this experience of transformation in this place. Now, I am proud of that. I am happy about it. And I will continue to write about Rennes Le Chateau because I do want people to go there for the right reasons. There are hundreds of thousands of people who visit this little teeny tiny village all the time. And as you know, we have had many conversations with Henry Lincoln where he has expressed regret about the fact that he ever wrote about the place and brought all of this attention to it. But I think from Henry's point of view, his regret is that there has been a lot of destruction in the region from the treasure hunting groups. And I think that that is his regret. But I don't think Henry should regret what he's done, because what he did was, it's so important for all of us. All of us who do care about the place. So I think that, you know, it's been a double-edged sword for him, but I certainly hope that he does find comfort and joy and happiness in the fact that so many people are coming there now for the right reasons and for the celebration of the place, and who care about restoring it and protecting it.
And definitely, I, you know, that transformation I have seen in Henry He has slowly, come back to accept who he is and to kind of like find himself again. And for somebody in their 70s to still take on that pilgrimage, I think is extremely important, and just shows you that the confrontation with the mirror and the transformational aspect is not tied to whether you're 5 or 55 or 105. But it doesn't mean that we are coming to the end of another episode of the Spirit Revolution. We are working on trying to organize something for next year so that we can all experience the sacred aspect of France and that specific era. So if you want to, you can already go to sacredfrance.com and leave your name, your email address there, and we will keep you in contact with this information as we have it. We will also put a link to there from our own website called thespiritrevolution.com.
And we are working on building Sacred France. So sacredfrance.com, our vision is to create a website that celebrates the places that we love so much, that provides travel information and travel tips for those of you who want to go and experience it on your own, the places that we love and why we love them, the places that we stay, the places that we eat, the places that have been truly transformational for us. So we hope to have all that information up there for you. Over the next couple of months, we'll be putting that together. And as Philip said, we're also going to begin doing very, very limited, very small retreats in the south of France. Maybe one a year. If they become popular, we might do a few more because we do want to keep them small. But we do want to be able to show you France from through our eyes and hopefully help you to have a transformational experience in the way that we have had. So, yeah, go to our website, sacredfrance.com, get on our mailing list, and we will keep you posted as we develop it.
But this is the Spirit Revolution.
The truth against the world.